Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hello, I'm John Elledge, and this is Skylines, the Cinemetric podcast. This is a bit of a first, actually. Like, we've done, you know, we often talk about cities that aren't London on this show. We often talk down the line to people in cities that aren't London. But this is the first time we've recorded a whole one somewhere a very long way from the capital. I'm currently in Liverpool. I am by the docks in this very fine studio, which is much nicer than ours, where they record the Anfield Wrap Liverpool FC fan podcast, with two hosts of said podcast, Neil Atkinson and John Gibbons. Hi, guys.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
And also with the writer and PR, Laura Brown.
Hello.
And we are going to talk about Liverpool. So, first question, what makes you people so bloody special? more seriously, I think there's... When we were talking about this, we were talking about doing it on sort of Scouse exceptionalism was kind of the phrase we came up with. And I think it's true that Liverpool does have a very strong civic identity. And I'm kind of wondering why. Where does that come from? Why? I think Liverpool probably has a stronger civic identity than most cities, even in the north of England. So what is it about Liverpool that's kind of given that to the world, do you think?
There's a real self-confidence in Liverpool that's different from a lot of other places. And I've worked in a lot of different cities, and Liverpool has this sense that it doesn't really care what you think about it when you're from the inside. If you write a negative headline, you'll know about it incredibly quickly.
Oh yeah, I've had that.
But there is a self-confidence about the place in that it... I think that people just think things from Liverpool mean that it's going to be better. They kind of get it. They sort of understand what the city's trying to say about itself. And they know, they probably couldn't tell you what it is, but they can definitely tell you what it isn't. If that makes any sense.
I think there's two things in what Laura said there that are dead interesting. The first thing is that can't always tell you what it is, but can tell you what it isn't. If there's a bit of a weakness around a lot of this stuff, a lot of it's defined against. And I think that's the being able to tell you what it isn't at times. You know, a lot of the sort of the vibe of Scouse not English is very much about sort of the not part is important. It does a lot of work in that sentiment. And the second thing as well is, you know, Liverpool is really self-confident. But as I often will say to anyone who grabs me, it's also a bit needy. If we're all honest about it, like, we need you to tell us we're great, and we want you to tell us we're great. So I'm literally on every level, on the most basic personal level. When you were walking around yesterday, John, on Twitter and photographing Liverpool, I was like, yeah, it is right, John. I was made up with you photographing Liverpool and saying, I've just come here, this bit's boss. And then I thought, that's really strange, John. I don't know how many followers John's got on Twitter or anything like that, but I was like, yeah, I feel like John's sticking it to someone here, and I'm quite pleased, and I don't know who, and he probably isn't, but yeah, good. Well in Liverpool.
No, I mean, I wasn't sticking it to anyone. I do genuinely sort of like think that it's something I'm keen to do in this job, both in the podcast and on Cinemetric itself, is kind of talk up bits of the country that, you know, I don't know very well and I think often don't get discussed very much. And the thing about Liverpool is it's bloody gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's got, there's some amazing architecture up here. And it just feels like you don't quite have enough people to fill it anymore. Is the main thing I kind of felt walking around. It's like, you can just kind of feel the depopulation that kind of happened in the middle of the last century. There's bits of town where there just aren't enough people.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? And I think, you know, how we kind of, you know, reverse that, I'm not quite sure. It's Liverpool hasn't really had the kind of new wave of immigration that a lot of other places have, and that makes it quite interesting as well, in that Liverpool has a very old Chinese community and obviously has a very old community, sort of Black Caribbean, but in terms of more recent kind of immigration, Liverpool didn't get as much as kind of other cities, and so it's actually a very white city, and although we believe we're a tolerant city and we believe we're standing against racism and stuff like that. In actual fact, when you walk around...
The city centre especially is incredibly white compared with other places in the city. Where I live is quite Middle Eastern. And it's... I like that because I'm half Middle Eastern. So, you know, it's something that you used to. But you do have pockets in Liverpool where different communities do live. And I think, you know, it's the Irish thing as well. You know, there's this stat that goes round that says 75% of people in the city have got Liverpool Irish heritage. Which is a crazily high sense. But maybe that's a bit about the exceptionalism as well, because people from here don't... There's the old adage about Liverpool, that Liverpool doesn't look down to London, looks out to sea. And there's that sense of it turns its back. But having that heritage within the city, that people aren't all from here, they all trace their roots to somewhere else, is quite important.
And that's also part of this... So again, to go back to this idea of defining yourself against, I think, you know, you can go back and find pretty atrocious editorials written about Liverpool from London and other places in the 1920s and even earlier, given as
the
part
20s.
Of this heritage. Yeah,
bloody hell.
Because part of this heritage, Liverpool had an Irish nationalist MP, I think, in the 1920s. And as part of, so the whole Liverpool being at odds or at war with the rest of the country thing is not something from the 80s. It goes back further and further, and it's part of this, you know, it's been an ongoing sort of aspect of both Liverpoolian culture, but also how Liverpoolian culture is seen from the outside, is this sort of thing. And that's why, you know, to go back to the defining against thing, it's one of the reasons why you do often end up defining against is because you feel there's a sense of attack. And I think that that's in there as well. And I think that again, is, you know, if you were to take all the cities in England, whether rightly or wrongly, and that's almost a separate conversation, but Liverpool has felt like it's been under attack more from anywhere else in England throughout, you know, if you go, and as I say, you can chart this, I think, for over 100 years that this is the case. So this is not a flash in a pan thing. It never is. It's always there, present somewhere, and has been in this sort of collective psyche. And so I think that is one of the live sort of parts of this, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I find it interesting that you say this story has been happening since at least the 1920s, because I kind of wondered if it was kind of a bit, it was around the... So the narrative of, you know, late 20th century decline, or, you know, the relationship with the Thatcher government, all that stuff. But maybe it kind of goes further back into... So like, historically, Liverpool obviously is basically here because there are 8 miles of docks, right? Yeah. It was like there are a million people here because you needed people to sort of load and unload ships. And the reason the city declined a bit is because you no longer need people to decline. Like, you've got containerization, you can do a lot of it electronically. But also, I kind of think, feel like... That heritage maybe sort of feeds into the story in a different way. So, like, as you were hinting, it's like it was kind of a very Irish city, wasn't it? I've heard Liverpool described as the capital of North Wales. There's sort of weirdly, I think, a relationship with New York because of the ferries.
Yeah.
There's a huge New York... I mean, I think it basically... So, last year, I launched a friend of mine wrote a book about the Liverpool Irish history, so... It depends how much in detail you want me to go in this, to be honest with you, because I know...
I mean, there's a lot of nerds listening to this, so knock yourself out, to be honest. So, hi, guys. Love you.
I think it's when the Irish famine happens, a lot of people come to Liverpool because they're going to go on to America. And a lot of the people who can't go to America end up staying in Liverpool. And the city's population swells by over 1 million. And it creates huge issues. One of the reasons why social enterprise and public policy is rooted, and like welfare is rooted, a lot of its history in Liverpool, is because when Irish immigrants come over fleeing the famine, there are huge social issues within the city, and the city pulls off its sleeves and goes, we need to sort this. So that's when you get all the Kitty Wilkins and stuff. That's when you get all of that kind of... A lot of the women of the philanthropists and of the city fathers, their wives kind of going, we need to figure this out, we need to sort this out. So that's when the population of the city really expands. But you sort of have this sense beforehand. I was talking to an artistic director about this last week, actually, because he thinks Liverpool's kind of anti-establishment thing actually comes from the fact that Chester is the first city of the Northwest. So that's the place where, like, the Roman set up. That's where the guilds are. That's where all the power is. And Liverpool is the place where you come to make a fast buck. So it has this tradition in literature in the sort of mid-19th century. It's like Liverpool is the place you come for a lost weekend. So Heathcliff is found in Liverpool. And there's a reason why they choose Liverpool rather than another place. That Liverpool's a bit of a lost place. It's where, you know, if you're genteel and part of the establishment, you don't go to Liverpool. You know, that's the place where you're going to end up with a load of prostitutes and you're going to end up in this hotel and no one's going to find you for a week. It's a bit racy.
I don't think I've ever seen Heathcliff portrayed as Scouse. This isn't
something I will claim anyone, yeah. John.
but there's kind of another side to this, which is like, so something else I kind of was very struck by on my walk yesterday is going through the Georgian Quarter, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's just these amazing sort of Georgian terraces and squares and so on. And it sort of brought to mind this idea that I don't think I've kind of made up, but like Liverpool was also at the height of the 19th century a very rich city, right? There are an enormous number of millionaires here, and you know, some of them probably made their money off, you know, the slave trade, which isn't great, but nonetheless there was money here. That's part of the story we don't tend to think about anymore, right? It seems to clash with the sort of idea of like Liverpool as this kind of like den of iniquity.
Yeah, I mean, it's real dot-com boom stuff, isn't it? I think. I don't know why I'm looking at Neil, so maybe he remembers it. It's like, do you remember those days when all the merchants were on the horses, Neil?
But I think I mean, what we've highlighted already a lot is the idea of Liverpool being a city of contradictions, and I think that is massive, and I think that's why it often is a place that's difficult to pinpoint, even if you've lived here a lot of your life, like all of us have. And I think, you know, If you look at the kind of the voting history of Liverpool, I mean, Neil points out the kind of Irish Republic, you know, MP, but also a lot of seats were Conservative right up until Thatcher, and then that was the kind of the sea change. Whereas, so this idea of Liverpool always being a socialist city isn't true at all. It's often been a Conservative with a small C city and indeed the capital C, and there's also, you know, along with all the kind of Irish history and stuff, there's a loyalist part of the city as well, and you know, you'll still see, you know, marching certain days of the year and things like that as well. So it is a kind of a strange kind of contradiction of a city, really, and that comes back a lot to what Neil said at the start, which is in one ways we're cocky and self-confident, and then in other ways, you know, we're not confident enough to let certain kind of things go.
Okay, so here's a question which, if I was kind of a normal adult male, I would know the answer to already. But like, you guys obviously do the Anfield Rap, which is the Liverpool FC podcast, right? Is the sort of Liverpool Everton split, is that a sectarian one?
Historically? No,
initially a little bit, but it's just never really taken. It's never really gone right the way through. So it just doesn't.
It's not like the Glasgow thing.
No,
you can't sustain it or carry it for any. There's, I mean, you know, you can really you could write a, you know, you could write a solid dissertation on it, but you could, you know, in terms of there actually being anything to discuss or get stuck into at this stage, there's nothing nailed on.
Yeah, there's a really good essay on the why Liverpool doesn't have sectarian violence associated with its football. It's a really interesting topic that it just doesn't. You know, it's. I mean, I kind of grew up thinking everyone on TV was Scouse and Catholic, and then sort of realised that the whole country wasn't, was a massive shock to me in the 90s, to be honest with you. And I think that, you know, you do have a strong Catholicism here, but it doesn't ever drip into animosity, I don't think.
I wonder if this is somehow to do with the very strong civic identity, in that, like, I mean, like, you guys were talking earlier about how, like, Liverpool is quite a white city, but it feels quite comfortable with multiculturalism and the fact there's been a Chinatown for more than a century and so on. So I wonder if it's because there's a very strong Scouse identity that people can kind of buy into that kind of overrides those other identities at all.
I mean, I think look, the idea that it feels comfortable with multiculturalism, I would say that it's easier to feel like that if you know, you haven't had... you know, a lot of it recently, and I think other places would say, but Liverpool haven't had influxes of people, or whatever you would call it, positive and negative, into an area. I think Liverpool's Chinese community is very old, so if you see a Chinese person in Liverpool, it's very likely they'll talk with a Scouse accent, and the same from kind of other places as well. And so, but I think maybe there is a feeling in Liverpool that if you decide you're one of us, you are accepted, and I think that does exist as well, and I think that's important. And that, you know, if you come here and you adopt the city as yours, it will look after you. And although that sounds kind of cliched and kind of a little bit cheesy, it's sort of true as well.
It's back to the needy thing. So if you come and say we're boss, we'll go, you're great. And if you choose to live your life here and do it in a way that embraces the city of Liverpool, then the city of Liverpool people will embrace you back. John said for years, and he's right, you know, look, it's one of my favourite lines, loads of the best scousers aren't from Liverpool, and we know people both on the sort of on the most basic level of people who throw themselves into Liverpool's cultural life. Recently John actually said it to me after the aftermath of someone who we only really worked with. John knew him better than I did, but we worked closely with, and he sadly passed away really young, a lad called John Hall, who used to run a record label, did the sound at Leaf, for a load of different places in the city, and did sound for us, and made things, just really was part of the city. And John was originally from Wales, and he came in from Wales, and he was just, but everyone, and you know, his funeral was a really sad affair, but really uplifting, because simultaneously it was the celebration of this life, this Liverpudlian life, lived by someone who's coming from the outside. And it's really stayed with me. I actually talk about it on About Welsh Show a week, to be honest. It's really weird. But that, I think, is, you know, that's an example of, that's what Liverpool, you know, is and wants and feels as though. And when Liverpool's doors are open, that's what it's open to someone who comes in and becomes part of what we do and loves all of that. And I think that is perhaps ever so slightly sort of influenced by the football. I think, you know, the idea of all of Liverpool's best teams have got Scots in them. Not just, but also that's an Everton thing as well. The idea that, you know, with the thing, if football is so crucial at the centre of cultural life or something, but it's made up and it's done by people who are not from Liverpool predominantly, then that becomes sort of something which everyone can sort of see that benefit in. And I think, I think Liverpool is, and that is part of it, and everyone gets sort of assimilated, but as they get assimilated, it changes. A friend of ours used to run, well, still does run bars, but, you know, basically created the bar culture of Liverpool's Albert Dock, and he's originally from Liverpool, and he brings booth culture to Liverpool. You can decide whether or not you think booth culture is a good idea or a bad idea, but he brings it in, but he's part of, and then that's part of that, and now Liverpool is still a place where you can have a lost weekend. It's emphatically a place where you can have a lost weekend, and that's a massive part of now what it is.
Yeah, and I think there's a sense, when you're a city that's at the end of the line, that's quite important, because you don't accidentally come to Liverpool.
Yeah.
It's the end of the train line. It's the last stop. Yeah. So you don't get that kind of transience either. You know, I think we're only behind Sheffield in one of the cities where when people come to university, they stay. Mm. That's really important. Like the gang who run the Casimir, that was the big, you know, they sort of took over the space. Now they've got Invisible Wind Factory, huge cultural force in the city. They were a group that came here as students, loved it, and stayed.
It's the same as the people who run Independent Liverpool, which is, you know, quite ironic, really. This Independent Liverpool kind of brand, if you like, that is all about promoting, well, what it sounds like, independent restaurants, bars, cafes in Liverpool. Are two lads, they're not from here. They just moved here from, you know, from another city and kind of stayed. And I think that could be quite a nice thing sometimes. And I think that, well, all the time, but also in terms of, I think, When you are from here, you can kind of focus on the negatives a little bit too much, I think, and then sometimes it needs people from outside to go, what you've just said, this architecture is amazing, you know, and you're like, yeah, when was the last time I actually looked up? Instead, I'm complaining about the rain and the wind.
No, I mean, interesting, talking about the social side of things, like thinking of nights out I had when I was a student, two of the most memorable, one of the best, one less so, that I still remember now 15 years on, were when I was in Liverpool. So one was like, I just came to see a friend who was at university here, and just getting this real sense of, like, you know, people just talk to you in bars.
Yeah.
And like, obviously you don't get that in London, like famously, but you don't get that in a lot of places. Whereas like, it was very easy without the aid of any sort of class A drugs to just get chatting to complete strangers in a way I've not really experienced anywhere else.
People do that everywhere here though.
It's exhausting.
It happens everywhere. You'll have chat on the bus, at the bus stop, buying a can of Coke. Everywhere, people just talk to each other all the time.
I think it is part of people being friendly, and then also partly everyone's got an opinion on something, and also a joke or whatever. Also feels like if someone's in my head, I'm going to tell someone, because it can't just remain in my head. And I think that's quite disgusting.
My sort of not counter example exactly, because I think it's probably part of the same thing. Is the other night I really remember out in Liverpool was with for the birthday of a friend who grew up here, and perfectly fine night out, nothing amazing. But I remember, like, we were just stood outside some chip shop afterwards after kicking out time. and this, and I just hear the word, you starting, mate. And I turn around, there's this guy a whole foot shorter than me, just squaring up to me. Like, oh, for God's sake. But I genuinely wonder if that's kind of part of the same phenomenon almost. It's just like this sense that, like, people are sort of rubbing along together for good. There's sort of less personal space involved. I don't know.
I have a theory, and I think it's still just about holds. It's still just about, broadly speaking, holds. And I hope it continues to hold. I think one of the reasons, one of the exceptional things about Liverpool, and I do mean this mostly as a positive, is that there's a real sort of equality of night out. That I think that most, you could have someone who runs, I'm trying to think of a good building that's nearby, a good big business that's nearby, Waitman's. So there could be someone who's really senior at Waitman's who could have the same night out as a woman who works at the reception at Waitman's, and they would end up going to similar places and they could literally have the same night out. Now, he could afford to have it every night of the week and she may only be able to afford to have it once a month or once every 2 weeks or something like that, but there's a real equality of night out. What you don't have is, is the idea that there's places where different types of people go to in Liverpool, but one of those delineations is rarely in the city centre. In the city centre is rarely rich or poor. Some places are more expensive than others, and that, you know, it's worth pointing that out. But that doesn't mean necessarily that someone who was really quite well off might not just choose to drink in a certain sort of place or type of place. And I think that remains a thing. Whereas when I go to London and see people, I think you can really get the flavour of there's lines in the sand and markers, and it's not quite as pure as I've just made it sound in Liverpool, and I want that to be quite clear that all the way through all of this, you know, we're not going, aren't we all wonderful and all this, but it is definitely a thing.
I think that is completely true, and I think that comes from where the delineation in Liverpool is. It isn't really a class thing, it's a culture thing. And it comes from music. So if you're looking for a night out, you're looking for a particular night out, and it's based on what kind of music you're into. So when the big disco crowd used to be, because disco and soul were like a massive thing in Liverpool, that was the Sunday night. So when you see that older generation that's still going out to, you know, the Carnarvon Castle, still going out to the Grapes on a Sunday.
And getting really dressed up, by the way.
Yeah, getting like absolutely to the nines. That's that night out, and that's where it kind of is still rooted. So when you're into a bit more, you know, your indie music of the 90s, we probably go to those same sort of pubs or the same streets that are along the same thing of where you'd go to in that. So like the Jacaranda down like sort of Slater Street kind of stuff around Ropewalks area, which was where more of the indie bars were. And it's kind of rooted in that because Liverpool hasn't got any snobbishness until you start talking about what your music taste is. And then it really starts to come out because it's that kind of tribal delineation.
I mean, growing up, everything I knew about Liverpool, you know, I'm a middle-class white man, so everything I knew about Liverpool came from, like, being obsessed with the Beatles for a couple of years.
They were good.
They did all right, yeah. But, I mean, I kind of find it, like, the Jacaranda's been around for decades, isn't it? Like,
the Beatles played the Jacaranda, yeah.
Like, I mean, that in itself is kind of fascinating. The idea that these places that are still active night spots that were literally there when the Beatles were starting out. It's kind of, that's, you know, 60 years ago nearly. That's crazy.
Yeah, but that doesn't feel like that long ago in Liverpool, though. I mean, it is that kind of city where... And I think there's this as well. Liverpool is a big storytelling place. So you get a Scouser talking about the city and you'll start telling stories about different places and heritage, and you'll start telling your stories, and you'll start telling your mum's stories and your dad's stories and uncle's stories, because it's all rooted in that. So actually, the Beatles played the Jacaranda. Well, I was going there in the 90s. And they still had pictures of the Beatles all over the wall. And it didn't feel that long ago in the 90s.
Yeah. We're not sort of... And I don't want people to come here to think we're living in some kind of, like, time warp where we've all stayed ever since the 60s. You mean, there's been some great bars kind of come and go and some great venues come and go. I mean, no more so than Cream, which is obviously the most famous dance... Well, dance night. It wasn't technically a club, but it was dance night in the world. And now is a building. Doesn't exist anymore. It's flats. There are kind of changes and shifts and things like that. But I think that the point about the storytelling is a good one. Is that when it kind of matters, Liverpool kind of will rally around somewhere that they feel is kind of important and kind of should be there. And you might say, well, I haven't been for years, but you know, I think it's important that something like that kind of takes place. And I think. I mean, that's quite a nice thing about Liverpool, although we did knock down the cavern and then build it again next door.
Yeah, I didn't realise that.
Yeah, that's not the cavern.
It's mad on a Friday afternoon. Go.
It's still more or less the same thing. They just knocked it down and realised that they shouldn't have done it, then built it, and they built it pretty much exactly the same next door.
But, I mean, Beatles tourism is a thing, right?
Yeah.
Like last time I was up here for the Labour conference 2 years ago, in fact, I was in a hotel above the Beatles Museum, and every morning be woken up by, like, you know, just some random compilation of Beatles. You look out the window, there's these two poor sods who are presumably out-of-work actors dressed like the Sgt. Pepper cover. But this is this is one of the reasons why, like, Liverpool, unlike most major English cities, kind of gets tourists, right? It's a place that people will come internationally to visit.
Yeah, they will. But it's funny that Liverpool kind of didn't really take advantage of that for a while, or didn't seek to, or maybe kind of it's become more of a thing. I don't know. So in the 80s, they did knock down the cavern, and there was also a kind of a feeling then that amongst a lot of musicians, certainly, that the Beatles thing was kind of holding Liverpool back. And so that Eric's kind of counterculture, where you had bands like kind of Dead or Alive and, I suppose, the Bunnymen kind of out there as well, was all kind of like quite snobby about the Beatles, if you like. And I think the city kind of moved on, maybe. And the Beatles as well, kind of, you know, they were straight to London as soon as they made a few quid. And so maybe there was kind of an element of, what, did they even feel like our band anymore? They've been embraced a lot more, I would say, recently. And then, you know, it only needs one place to do well, and then other places kind of doing it. So the idea is, I think, round Matthew Street, it can feel like a bit of a Beatles theme park sometimes. That's only really in the last 10 years that it's been a case of, you know, naming every bar after a Beatles album and having the Hard Day's Night Hotel and things like that. That's kind of something that's emerged, I would say, over the last decade or so, Neil.
I think it's a bit longer. I think it probably goes back to, I think this is an example of me and you, John, thinking we are 6-7 years younger than we actually are, which is, you know, where we are these days. I think that's probably because, you know, for instance, when I was 18, I was drinking in Lennon's Bar.
Yeah.
So I remember that. That's 20 years ago. And I think Liverpool really embraces the Beatles around then, and the tourism of it. And I think that a lot of Liverpool's tourism does come from Beatles tourism for a while, and that is the predominant sort of motivating factor. I think it's different now. I think Liverpool's tourism now is back to Lost Weekend, it's back to Stags and Hens, loads and loads of Stags and Hens. I used to live on Duke Street, which I once counted what I'm quite sure is 22 separate hen parties in one weekend, just seeing 22 separate hen parties in one weekend.
I mean, my God, you must have been knackered.
My science wasn't necessarily phenomenal, but I think I was right. It used to be something I just do in my own head of a weekend. And the other thing is the football as well. People come for the football. So I think that it's now separated. But there was a period, you know, if you go back to, I think, from about, you know, 99 to about 05, where I think, you know, the Matthew Street Festival was absolutely huge. It became a week-long thing that dragged people in. And that was a massive, massive part of what got Liverpool back into tourism. I think post-08, it may be a bit different. I think it is a bit different post-08.
You mean, is that because of the crash or the capital culture thing? Or both?
The capital culture thing. Yeah. I think the capital culture thing, even though it didn't do a lot of long-term what it was said it would do on the tin for Liverpool from the point of view of sort of setting us up as this wonderful bastion of brilliant culture subsequently, and that's completely to do with people who are authorities rather than anything to do with people on the ground who still do brilliant work and make brilliant work happen in Liverpool. They sort of managed to do so despite what they're up against at times. It feels that way. But I think what 08 did was it just sort of made everyone have to talk about Liverpool. And again, in that way of the self-confidence and the neediness we want, in the way in which, like, Hull has just not embraced it. In a national sense, they've not worked out how to embrace it, either they've not been able to embrace it, or they've just not embraced it properly. And they've not sort of said to the rest of the country, come and join our big party. Whereas Liverpool did do that. And I think that a number of different factors came in and held sway post-08. Not least the fact that some people thought there's people who own hotel groups went, there's ways to make loads of money out of this, you know, people will come to Liverpool. And from there, that momentum sort of pounded and pounded and pounded, and we get to where we are now, which is where tourism is absolutely massive. The nighttime economy is huge.
I'm going to push back slightly on the whole thing, because I wonder if this is actually just a function of scale. Like, we had the journalist Jasmine Anderson, who's from Hull, on here a couple of weeks ago, and she was talking about how brilliant it had been for the city. So I wonder if that message hasn't got through. It's just because, like, Liverpool is quite a lot bigger and there's a lot more scales in kind of influential positions down in London.
Could be absolutely right.
The difference, there's a couple of things that happen culture-wise that change massively. Liverpool benefits hugely from an absolute peak in people writing about culture. So there are way more culture writers 10 years ago than there are now. So Hull doesn't benefit as much from that because there aren't physically as many column inches in national newspapers devoted to culture that there were a decade ago.
So it just got fragmented across multiple venues. And
Whereas I think curatorially, what Hull has done artistically is probably more interesting than Liverpool did artistically. Hull has done some really incredible things and has created more of a cultural infrastructure. Liverpool already had a cultural infrastructure. What it didn't have was a tourism infrastructure. So the reason when you have that kind of the £8 for every one invested in Liverpool, what Liverpool did with 2008 was said, we've already got this great culture here. What you need to do is come and see it, and we need places for people to stay. So the reason you get the huge return is you get the absolute explosion in hotel numbers and explosion in like hotel beds and occupancy. That's what really, really shifts it in that year. And it's why it made so much money for the city.
I go to quite a lot of the cities as part of my job. And like some of them, you do go and you think, oh, God, this place is stuffed. To be blunt about it, like I would never tweet that or anything. But you do go to places and think, yeah, I can see why this place is in trouble. Whereas like Liverpool, I always think there's just like so much. There are so many selling points here. It's an amazing city to wander around. It's got so many sort of great shops and bars and like architecture. It's got decent enough transport and so, you know, it's not, it's a place that doesn't feel like it should be in trouble. So I kind of wonder if that's just like, it was just starting in a better position. It's more about like the capital of culture thing maybe worked because you could just, well, it just reminded everyone that it was here.
Well, I think, that was basically the thing. When we were sitting in the meetings with, because I was working for one of the, as they were termed, the Big Eight, I think they're the Big Ten now, at that year. So I was sitting in all those kind of like strategy meetings. And it wasn't designed to talk to people in Liverpool because you knew people in Liverpool got the culture. Liverpool Biennial had already been running since 2000. The Objective One money had already come into play, so a lot of that conversation had already been had with people in the city. But what it was about getting people to get on the train and come up, and basically London saying, it's ridiculous, it's 2 hours away, it's ridiculous that you don't come up here for a weekend. And that was the main strategy to do it. And it was weird that it was about creating a series of moments kind of before social media. I mean, before Instagram, the city was designing these, like, you know, Ringo Starr's going to be on a roof playing the drums, which is just a stupid thing to do. But that's just kind of what Liverpool does culturally. It kind of created those sort of set pieces. The problem is now is that everywhere kind of creates set pieces because everyone wants to have that Instagram moment. So it's how you keep developing that and keep changing it.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, just breaking off from that conversation to have the latest instalment of our news segment, Ask the Expert, in the form of Andrew Carter, Chief Executive of the Centre for Cities. Hello, Andrew, how are you?
Hello, I'm very well. How are you doing, John?
I'm good. It is a big question for you. I'm kind of interested in your take on. We talk a lot, you know, both on this podcast and on City Metric and indeed in, you know, the research you guys put out about, you know, the north-south divide, for want of a better term. There's a big economic divide down the centre of England, particularly. Is it fixable? Is it something that the government could actually do something about? Or is it just, you know, this is what the world is going to look like now until some other industrial revolution comes along and changes it?
Yes, no, again, you know, very big question. I think it's an issue that we can do something about. Whether we can fix it in the way that some seem to think, where essentially, you know, all parts of the, you know, of the country are equally prosperous or, you know, perform equally well, I'm less clear about. But I think it is certainly something that with considered effort that will take a long time. But if the commitment is there, we can do something about it. And we could certainly make more of our places outside of the south or the greater southeast more productive to have higher skilled, higher wage, better jobs that improve standards of living in those sorts of places that we're worried about. So I think there are things that we can do. I don't think we'll ever have, you know, the equality that we've got, in part because the UK is somewhat unique compared to other places, and that London is a very big city, which in itself is, you know, not every other country has very big cities, primate cities, as we would call them in the jargon, but also because of its global context, it is a very prosperous place. So, you know, in a sense, we're not going to equalize the north to the south because of London, but we could certainly make the Midlands and the north most prosperous if we commit to, I think, fairly significant changes in the way that the government, the country is run, much more devolving of powers and responsibilities, particularly, but not exclusively, to our city regions. Give them the powers, at the very least, that London has. Probably give them more of the powers that Scotland and Wales have, to Greater Manchester, to Greater Leeds, to Greater Sheffield, to Greater Birmingham, the West Midlands. I think there's a kind of constitutional response and question. And then I think that, you know, on the back of that, they, you know, giving them more autonomy, more responsibility over those kind of policy issues that matter, that we know matter, around transport, around skills, particularly, very particularly around skills, some around business support. I think you can see over time how those places can become more prosperous. Now, London will become more prosperous as well, but those places for certain can become more prosperous over time.
I mean, like, England is not unique in having a divided economy. A few months ago on this podcast, I spoke with some of your colleagues about the there's a north-south divide in Italy. It's the other way up. The north is the rich bit, but nonetheless, that is also a very divided economy. The US, there is a big gap between, you know, New York and San Francisco and Boston and Washington on one side and, you know, much of the sort of inner heartlands on the other. Why is it so, you know, particularly given that England is such a small country geographically, like, why is there such a, how do we end up with this chasm? And how did it end up feeling like such a sort of core part of national debate?
Really? Yeah, no, well, and I think in part it's because, and I know you've talked about this and written about this before, and others have as well, it's because, in a sense, London has several different meanings depending on how you're thinking about it. And the dominance of London is seen not just economically, which it is, you know, let's be, you know, for example, you know, 30%, at least 30%, of the national's tax revenues are generated by Greater London. Mm. You know, that's a massive contribution that one part of the, you know, of the country makes to the overall exchequer. You know, it's about a quarter of the economy, however you define it. So, you know, it's a big place in a small country and it makes a significant contribution. But I think it's more than that. You know, we see this in the, you know, in the Brexit vote and indeed the implications that result from it. London increasingly is felt by others to be somewhat different. And so the angst and, you know, the concerns about the dominance of London economically also then flow into questions about cultural dominance, political dominance, social dominance. And I think all of those things get wrapped up, which is why, you know, we do have an obsession and a focus on this inequality.
Now, it's interesting the point you make about London can mean different things, because it's not, in the way it appears in the national debate, it doesn't just mean the city, it doesn't just mean Greater London, it can mean the political establishment, it can mean the civil service, it can mean the government, it can mean the South East more generally, it can on some occasions mean the Conservative Party, even though London is increasingly not a Conservative city.
Yeah.
So it often feels like when we have these conversations, we're slightly talking at cross purposes. But I guess it does sort of mean that, like, people sort of rage against the North-South divide because they're unhappy with the government rather than with the South or London generally.
Yeah, and I think, you know, they think that, and you know, there's a degree of truth in this. They think that national government, because it's based in London, because it's primarily staffed by people who live in and around London or, you know, in the home counties, make decisions that preference London over other places. You know, and you see the debate around some of the numbers used to indicate transport investment, for example, you know, showing that London gets more. And we can debate the, you know, the merits of that sort of debate. But, you know, there's a sense that London is preferenced by national government, and actually, therefore, these places are not, you know, are not preferenced in the same way. The additional element, again, interestingly, unlike other places that we just talked about, I think it's worsened by actually when we look outside, some of our bigger cities are not yet performing the role in the national economy that big cities perform in other places. Now, if you go to Germany or you go to America, or if you go to even small places like Netherlands or France, even, you know, it's their biggest cities typically are above the national average on a whole range of economic measures. In many respects, our big cities are not doing that yet in the UK. You know, Manchester, Leeds is about a national average, just slightly above Bristol is. But Birmingham and Manchester, two big places, you know, you're talking what, 5.5 million, nearly 6 million people, you know, living and working in these places. You know, they are at or just below the national average. That's, we need to deal with that issue. And so, you know, providing them with more powers, responsibilities and autonomy around the policies that matter, transport, planning, skills, housing. You know, that's one of the ways that we can get those places firing, performing more strongly. They themselves will have a, you know, kind of drag up effect. And then we can deal with some of the other questions and issues as well. So, you know, we're unique in a kind of bunch of different ways, which I think why gives us, you know, an emphasis on this north-south or regional inequality question, which plays out differently in other places.
Why is it that our big cities are not performing? Like, this is weird, right? It is weird that the second city of England, whichever one you want to give the title to, is not one of the sort of economic powerhouses of the country yet. Most countries don't work like that. Do we have any sense of how that happened or why that happened?
We looked at some of the work and looked at sort of economic change over a 100-year period, you know, which we've talked about, you know, before. And if you think about, you know, places like Manchester and places like and Birmingham, they were centres of production, particularly industrial production, but not exclusively production. And of course, over the 20th century, these places, you know, a lot of those jobs were lost. You know, over 500,000 jobs lost in industry in Manchester between 1911 and 2016. You know, that's a huge, you know, job creating effect that they've had. Now, part of the challenge for them has been to replace those jobs. And, you know, whilst they've been able to do that, it's only in 2016 that they now have more jobs today than they did 100 years ago.
That's right? Crazy.
Right? Yeah. And so, you know, thinking about that kind of job generating challenge, is it just enormous? You know, these cities have gone through quite large structural changes in a context where, you know, for a great number of time, we just basically, you know, we often wrote these places off. You know, we wrote Manchester off. Liverpool, you know, government publications of the day and notes of the day in the 70s and 80s said basically, you know, this is managed decline. You know, these sorts of big cities have had their time. So policy wasn't orientated or focused to them. It's only really city-focused policy in the last 10 or maybe 15 years at max. This will take a while to play out. This will take a while to play out.
But I still find myself wondering, sorry, this is turning into not that short a segment now, but I find myself wondering why in other countries cities went through these transitions and managed to move from manufacturing to services. It's effectively what we're talking about. London moved from manufacturing to services. It just feels like it's not obvious to me why Manchester, for example, didn't do the same very easily. I'm just kind of wondering.
As you say, I think that's right. I think, you know, there was an element where manufacturing jobs were held on to in many of these places for as long as they possibly could. That was still regarded as the future. I think, you know, thinking about the manufacturing nation, I think a lot of these places became sites for alternative, even in the service industry, alternative jobs, but were still relatively low skilled and low paid. You know, if you think about what happened in London, you know, London lost, you know, hundreds of thousands of manufacturing jobs. But even 100 years ago, it had a kernel of, or more than a kernel of, you know, knowledge-intensive activity, which it then built on and expanded and grew, you know, and so success begets success in these kind of places. And as the economy turns, they're better advantaged to, you know, to take advantage, or they're better placed to take advantage of these sorts of opportunities. I think it takes a while for these places, you know, to go through that cycle. That process.
So is the point that, like, London did have a manufacturing base that we sometimes forget now, but it also was always, it was a port city. It had services to kind of service that port. Is it that it always had that kind of diversification in some of these other places?
It did. It had a more diverse economy. You know, it wasn't just a site of production of goods, you know, things. It was a cycle of production of ideas and innovation, which is historical. And that allowed it to be in a better position than it was. But, you know, my other thought would be, and you hear this even relatively recently, but certainly, you know, there was a time where we thought of the North and Midlands as being places of manufacturing, of production, of, you know, hard jobs done by, you know, predominantly done by men. That was the future. That was how we thought about them. And you can see that even today. You know, 70% of the regional growth fund allocation into the North and Midlands went into manufacturing activity. Now, I'm not saying that's wrong, but half of the investment we make in innovation goes into the greater southeast. You know, so, you know, there's a sort of thinking about how we think about the North and its future and how we think about the South. Someone said the future of London is manufacturing, right? We would laugh. I would laugh. I hope you would laugh. But you still hear that as being the future of places in the Midlands and the North. I'm just not convinced of that. I think there is, you know, there'll always be a role for manufacturing and high-end production in these sorts of places. But that's not the future. And I think it's only relatively recently that the leadership in these places has seen that and, you know, and now doing the things that are needed in order to adapt their places to the economy of the 21st century, not the economy of the 19th century.
Well, this is a big topic. It's one I'm sure we'll come back to. In the meantime, if someone wants to get in contact with a question for you to answer on this segment, how can they contact you?
Well, you can get me on Twitter, my handle is @AndrewCities, or obviously get in touch with John and I'm sure he will pick up the most difficult questions and ask me to try and answer them.
I look forward to that.
Excellent.
I want to move the conversation on a little bit and ask a slightly left-field question, which is Liverpool in the North? Because it feels to me like it sits slightly outside that kind of wider northern identity in some way, but I can never work out why, and if that's just me being me.
I mean, geographically, it's actually further south than you think as well, isn't it? And I think it has got that, and you know, there's all the stuff that the Law was saying before, well, what both of you were saying before about the connections kind of Wales and stuff, it's... I think it's in the North in some ways and not in us. There does seem to be a different mindset the further kind of west you go, and I think that's a kind of, I don't know, Liverpool feels maybe a more emotional city, and I think that's something that's kind of a bit kind of misunderstood sometimes. Where, I mean, I've got friends in Manchester and friends in Leeds, and you know, when from a football point of view, they'll say, "Oh, you all want to calm down a bit," you know, because something bad might happen, and you're like, "Listen, honestly, we don't worry about that at all." You know what I mean? We don't worry about, you know, worry less about looking silly if it goes wrong or things like that. And I think that there is a cautiousness across the rest of the North, and a thing of, you need to look not necessarily cool, but kind of, you know, composed, and this kind of idea of, you know, not getting carried away. And I think that, you know, I mean, maybe kind of Newcastle's a little bit different, but I'd say certainly Lancashire and Yorkshire, there's a desire not to get carried away. Whereas in Liverpool, I mean, we'll get carried away.
Yeah, we have zero chill.
We'll get carried away the drop of a hat.
Yeah, we love getting carried away. it's happened to me now, to be honest with you. There is something, I think that Liverpool and its relationship to the North is absolutely fascinating, in that I think you sort of end up, because of all the sort of, you know, if you do the list of the almost the cultural sort of tags, and you probably end up with Liverpool in balance. Yeah, you put it in that northern little bracket there. You do that, but there is loads of bits where it is in opposition is the wrong way to phrase it. I think that there's, you know, but I do think that the further east you go, the further you go along that M62, you know, for instance, I think it's easier to list things we've got in common with Manchester possibly than it is to list things we've got in common as you go right the way along the corridor. I think they do begin to drop off to a certain extent, and some of them, and then others come into play. So I'm fascinated by it. I think it's a really good question. I don't think it's got an easy answer.
But just on the most basic level, like, I think there is more of a difference between the Liverpool accent and the Manchester one than there is between the Manchester one and like the Hull one. I think the Mancunian and the Yorkshire accents are like quite similar. Whereas
you try and do impression of one different. And you'll break into the other.
I mean, I as a Southerner, I can't tell the difference. Like genuinely, in the number of people I've met where I've kind of guessed and got the wrong one, whereas I would never have difficulty working out someone's from Liverpool. So
until they tell you they're from Wirral, and then everything goes off.
Thank you very much.
But it's the thing of like it's the weather as well. So I think one of the reasons that sometimes we don't feel northern is that it never snows here. So we get snow like once every 10 years and there'll be like feet of snow across the north of England and we'll be in sunshine with a scarf on because we have this weird we're in
sort of maritime climate.
Yeah, we're in a bay, so we've got the Welsh Hills protecting us from one side, we've got the bottom of the Pennines on the other, and the Lancashire Hills, so we're really protected from bad weather. So I think having our own climate makes us feel quite separate as well because we are a bit windy but temperate.
Well, one of my favourite things to tell any sort of Lancastrian is that Lancashire cricket team won the Division 1 title the year they played in Liverpool, and that was because Old Trafford was closed, but they won it because it didn't rain. And so Lancashire as a cricket team lose so many days a year just to bad weather that they can never, you know, they draw too many games, whereas they moved to Liverpool for a year and won the title and with a not particularly good team either, but that's quite good fun to kind of make fun out of Lancastrian also. But also it does just show that, you know, we are kind of lucky with the weather here as well. We don't get the kind of extremes. We don't get as much rain in Manchester, and as you say, we don't get these kind of, you know, big bouts of snow. You know, I mean, it's still cold most of the year. Don't get me wrong. I'm not kind of trying to point out that it's Malta or anything, but you know, but we are quite fortunate.
What about what does Liverpool need? Like, if there was a sort of wish list, what would you like to happen in the city to kind of like move things forward?
People, you said it before, and I think it's a really valid point. I think it's, you know, I think it needs to be engaged with better, and possibly engage better with massively in inverted commas, its enemies. I think there's a big problem that basically the Conservative Party has completely given up on Liverpool. And if the Conservative Party is going to be, let's be optimistic and say 50% of the time, the ruling party of government, I think it's a problem that they come sixth and seventh in mayoral elections in Liverpool and they show no sign and no desire to change that in any substantial way. They don't care. They don't want to put the time, the money, the resources, the brain power into thinking, how do we do that differently? And I think that, and there's not much that we can do about that, I don't think, but I think that that is a bit of a problem, that there is this sort of, in many ways, people being able to shrug their shoulders and go, that's Liverpool, innit?
That's somebody else's problem.
Yeah. Or they're just mad. You know, and that is a problem. I think that that is a problem, and that's something that I'd love to see change sort of in a nationwide sense, is that people shouldn't be able to just shrug their shoulders and go to Liverpool and they're mad. They should instead go, maybe they're getting things right, or maybe they've got at least a really valid point of view. You know, the response to the momentum thing around the sun from people who should just be perfectly reasonable and be able to think outside of their own brains for 5 minutes was staggering, to be quite honest with you. It was absolutely staggering. And you get one of them, I mean, you know, you get one of them about every time you people come for this thing, but you get one of them about every, you know, you get one of them about every 6 months where you're just sort of going, I don't understand why you can't for 5 minutes think from that city's point of view about X. Why can't you do that? And that doesn't just cross itself on party political lines either. You know, there's people who would put themselves in a pretty left-wing bracket who I think you can occasionally, every now and again, there'll just be this moment and you'll go, oh, come on, this isn't difficult.
Yeah, I thought that was ridiculous the way that... we should probably give context for anyone who's missed it, but The Sun is not being allowed at the World Transformed Momentum's conference in parallel to the Labour conference. As a reflection in large part of like the fact that The Sun has been sort of half banned from Liverpool for decades now.
The Sun is not on anyone's press list in this city. I mean, you don't send press releases to them. It's just, you don't. Yeah.
But it instantly became like discussed as a story about how like Momentum are against free speech rather than like, no one was like, well, why is this major national newspaper like so off the agenda in a major English city? Nobody kind of considered that. And also, just from a purely personal point of view, I don't really understand why journalists are kind of sticking their neck out to defend The Sun, because The Sun would not stick its neck out for them.
No,
that's a really valid point. But I think
The Sun would kill you just to watch you die, but that's a whole different thing.
But I think, yes, I think that ongoing is a thing we need more. But more, I think more people and for businesses to move here and for different types of businesses to move here. I don't think it's in Liverpool's interests to end up trying to be part of a sector. I think Channel 4 would have been brilliant, but there's reasons why Channel 4 haven't happened, and Laura will speak far better about that than I will. But there are, you know, loads of internal issues around that and around Liverpool's strange local government and all that sort of thing. But genuinely, you know, if people are listening to this and they're thinking about relocating a business, you could just do so much worse than
you can live so well here.
You can live so well here, you know, the property prices, you know, and all in all of this, let's not pretend there's not areas of Liverpool that are unbelievably deprived still, because they very much are, and it's important to tag them and mention them within all of this. But that's part of all of that is the next steps of ongoing either generation or regeneration. I don't think it's necessarily called. There's areas of Liverpool that need to be regenerated, but Liverpool itself needs to generate constantly rather than have this idea that there has to be a programme of regeneration now. But I think that's part of all of that. I'd love to see, you know, I'd love the news that, you know, across the course, forget the tourism stuff's great, the nighttime economy is so important. But, you know, the idea that Liverpool found a way to pull in three or four quite substantial businesses that led to a number of people relocating would be fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I think the huge government development that's happening on Water Street is going to be a big pull for that.
Yeah.
It's not HMRC, isn't it? It's HM Government. I can't remember what department it is. But it's a Home Office thing, and I think that's going to be really big. I think regeneration-wise, I completely understand why the Objective 1 focus was on the city centre, because the city centre was a whole. And the city we grew up in was very, very different. I mean, that, like, you know, that last shot of the Boys in the Black stuff when you see the Albert Dock and it's all, like, filled in, that's what it looked like when we were kids. Mm. And it was a very, very different place. You didn't come to the city centre as much as you would now. But the problem is that infrastructure in the city has completely replicated that idea. So to get to... if I'm getting to Anfield or if I'm getting to Norris Green and I live in Wavertree, I have to get into the city centre to get out again. Whereas actually it's only a sort of 15-minute journey across the city. And improving that infrastructure from village to village would make a lot more sense, because that would improve much more of a city identity. So that's one thing it needs. The other thing it needs is a design review panel, so that when new buildings are proposed in the city, they go across a... Instead of going to the planning committee first, they go to a design review panel that decide whether it's nice or not.
Yeah, I think, look, there's lots that can be done kind of nationally, I think, and I think from a government point of view. And I think, you know, it's great that the Corbyn, I think, is focused so much on trains in the north, because I think that's something that's massively been neglected. Okay, we can get to London a lot quicker, and that's great, but why is it so hard to get to Leeds? Why is it so hard to get to Sheffield?
It's so hard to get to Manchester.
And so and on the just the worst trains that you can imagine as well. And so that's something that I'd love to be focused on. But in terms of looking internally and what can we do, I think our messages could be braver. I think we could think bigger a little bit, and I think Liverpool's kind of lost its ambition in some senses from a city point of view. And it's also that the message is kind of a little bit mixed. We've ended up in this weird situation where we've got three mayors, and that's kind of a little bit odd. And of course, you know, one of them's just civic and just, you know, opens things and stuff like that. But, you know, it's still a bit of a strange thing. And before you get into a discussion about the quality of those people, you know, just generally the fact that there's three of them just kind of seems a bit daft.
I didn't realise there were three. So you've got Joe Anderson, the elected mayor of Liverpool City Council.
Yeah.
You've got Steve Rotherham, who's the metro mayor for Liverpool and five other effectively suburban boroughs. Yeah. Who's the third?
There's a kind of civic Lord mayor. Right, okay. So someone who, you know, who would maybe mainly just appear at things and look good and have some bling. But I think it just still does kind of get a bit confusing for people. And obviously, you know, Joe Anderson is still quite often the people will go to for a quote, because he's so willing to kind of speak out and things. And you know, I think that...
Also, he has the better job title. He's mayor of Liverpool as opposed to the mayor of the Liverpool City region, which, like, you kind of need half a dozen footnotes just to explain what that is. Like, mayor of Liverpool, you can just instantly understand.
Yeah.
But now, as I understand it, like, there was sort of an assumption that he would move aside and it would go back to a kind of council and leader system.
But no one told him.
I think he wanted Rotherham's old seat, which is Liverpool Walton, possibly, but then didn't get it, so he refused to go anywhere. But that might not be true.
There's one other thing, just quickly on what Laura said. We always end up talking about trains, but it is worth mentioning buses. To a friend of mine, Steve, I said this weekend, and it's absolutely spot on that Kensington in London, you can get a bus for £1.50. It's Kensington in London. Kensington in Liverpool, it's £2.20.
And the Kensington in Liverpool is not nearly as nice as the Kensington. Like, it's a much more deprived area.
Yeah, right? Yeah. 2:40 now, is it?
2:30.
2:30 now.
2:30 flat fare across the city.
And so, it's, you know, this is, you know, an ongoing thing there. It's literally how buses work in Liverpool, and I think that's part of what Laura's driving at, you know, but also how much they cost is absolutely wild. And we always end up talking about trains, and there's loads of reasons why we all end up talking about trains, but actually, you know, more buses and buses being cheaper would be no bad thing.
We should probably be wrapping up, but just before we do you guys want to say a couple of words about the Anfield Wrap and what it is you guys do exactly?
Oh, God. We were the Anfield Wrap, and we produce podcasts. We do video and we do writing. The core of what you can call our business in terms of what makes money so currently is podcasts. We do two of them that are free on a weekly basis. We do one of them about music, which is called The Rider, and we do two which are predominantly about football and about Liverpool Football Club. And then we do about another somewhere between 12 and 14 shows that go behind a paywall, and we charge £5 a month for them. We've got some partners of people who we work with, companies we work with, and companies who we mention. And the 12 to 14 shows don't just talk incessantly about Liverpool's most recent football match. We'd like to think that we manage to reflect aspects of a slightly younger Liverpool culture than one that gets reflected in a lot of places. I always have to be careful about this. I was on a panel with Laura when I first met her, and one of the things that I sort of pointed out was that everyone on the panel was, that I think at that stage, I think it was over 34. So I think you've got to be careful, but we do very much want to reflect Liverpool culture post 08, post lots and lots of different things. We'd like to think that we do that, and we'd like to think that people come for the football, but they stay for the jokes.
I think it's a way of adding to all that, that the Anfield Wrap started as something that was a hobby and is now a thriving business in Liverpool, a new media business that employs 10 people, soon to be 11 full time, and a lot of our contributors are paid as well. We're in our own studio that we've built in an office right in the heart of the Liverpool, and I think that in itself, I think, is an interesting story away from the fact that we talk about football, the fact that I don't think there's many podcasts in this country, if not the world, who have successfully built a subscription model that is to an extent that there's 10, now it seems to be 11 people working full time on it. And so that should have your interest, even if Liverpool Football Club doesn't.
Well, thank you very much for letting us use your studio, and thanks for coming on.
You've been listening to Skylines, the podcast from City Metric, the New Statesman City site. It was presented and produced by me, John Ellidge. If you enjoyed the episode, then please do consider leaving us an iTunes review. It really helps other people to discover the show. And, you know, the more people get listening to the show, the sooner I can achieve my real goal of world domination for the medium of trains. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
This is a Brooklyn-bound
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.